vive la canadienne,
vole,
cœur vole,
vive la canadienne.
Et ses jolis yeux doux, et ses jolis yeux doux, 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 et ses jolis yeux doux.
Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with...
Luke Savage. Welcome back, everyone. And by way of something one of our listeners said in the comments on our latest episode, a slight mea culpa for myself is in order, because during our last episode on the David Cronenberg movie Existenz, I erroneously referred to a Robin Hood episode of Star Trek The Next Generation as a holodeck episode, to which a fan has pointed out that, in fact, John DeLancey's Q whisks the Enterprise away to the magical land of Sherwood Forest, and I was incorrect to state that it was in fact a holodeck episode. So the Michael and Us podcast regrets this error.
Well, how about that? There are a lot of listeners who probably think that we're never wrong, but it seems that finally after 342 episodes, there is finally a flaw in the diamond.
Well, I got a news story to share with you off the top here, Will. I'm not sure if you've heard about this. This is the latest development in the world of international diplomacy, sending shockwaves through the geopolitical fabric of our world. Canada and Denmark reached settlement over disputed Arctic island, sources say. Now, this is from the Globe and Mail. It was published about 10 days ago. Just wanted to share this incredible news with all of you. Canada and Denmark have reached a settlement in a decades-old border dispute over Hans Island, which is in the Arctic Sea Passage between Greenland and Ellesmere Island.
That's also the name of the island in Enter the Dragon. I assume it's not the same island.
I think it's a different island. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit more about the settlement here. The Canadians and Danes plan to unveil the settlement on June 14th and celebrate it as an example of how countries can resolve border disputes peacefully, even as Russia ignored the rules-based international order and launched a full-scale military assault on Ukraine, the sources say. So this is a decades-long, you know, land dispute, border dispute, and, you know, the governments, respective governments of Canada and Denmark coming together to show that, you know, there are peaceful ways to resolve complicated international disputes with very high stakes involved. Now, I want to tell you a little bit more about the island in question. It's 1.3 square kilometers across. It looks like this. The listeners aren't going to see it, but I'm just going to show it to Will.
Okay. Uh-huh. It's not so much an island as a rock.
It's basically a rock in the middle of the ocean. It's uninhabited, obviously. There may be, I don't know, fishing rights and things like that. There may be more that's consequential to it. But anyway, there's nothing really to say about this. I just thought it was pretty funny that the spin here from the governments of, you know, two fairly small countries in terms of population, the spin on it is like, we're showing that, you know, diplomacy and the rules-based international order can prevail. Never doubt that, you know, the governments of two democratic countries can come together to resolve a dispute. The resolution, by the way, was to divide the rock down the middle. So Canada now has a land border with Denmark.
Oh God, yet another foreign threat to be worried about.
And of course, the whole thing is silly because, as Professor Michael Byers, as quoted in the article, says, Canadians should remember the Inuit and Greenland and Nunavut are the same people, and they did not have the boundaries and borders prior to Europeans arriving. Anyway, we're recording this on a Sunday, feeling pretty relaxed. You know, my days during the week are pretty stressful right now, working hard on a big project. Will and I have actually seen an unusual amount of each other recently. We've seen each other socially a few times outside of the context of the Gore Lieberman Studios, outside of its suffocating confines. It's been pretty nice. Last week,
a lot of people have been criticizing me for fraternizing with the boss, as it were. But, you know, I'm not about class hierarchies.
Well, last night we went to a bar because a friend of the show, Bronco Marketeach, was in town. I think Bronco won't care if I've doxed his location. He is presently in Toronto, and we've been hanging out with him. And I don't really remember too much of what was said last night, but I think we did get into extended conversation. I think that started as a joke and then got fairly serious about, you know, the internal politics of the Mushroom Kingdom and whether there's enough material in, you know, the Donkey Kong extended universe for some kind of, you know, contemporary adaptation. Would that be any good?
Yeah, folks, maybe you had to be there, but it has struck me as kind of crazy that there's never been a Donkey Kong movie. Like, he's one of the most beloved characters of all time.
Well, what prompted this, I think, was it you dropped the news that they're making like a Tetris trilogy?
I didn't know about that. I did know that there is currently at present a Super Mario animated film being made with the voice of America's favorite Chris Pratt as Mario. But I'm not familiar with this news of a Tetris movie. I'm glad it's a trilogy. I mean, if you've ever played the game, you know one game is never enough. But, you know, we've been talking a lot lately about the Super Mario Brothers movie, the one with Bob Hoskins in it. And I was reminded that I saw an interview with one of the directors of that movie explaining their vision for the film, which, of course, was heavily compromised, you know, during the shooting and during the editing. But their vision, and I'm quoting almost directly, was to do...
Otherwise, it would have been Citizen Kane, basically.
The vision was to do something for Mario like what Tim Burton did for Batman, which is so funny if you stop to think about it for a sec. Like, you watch the Super Mario movie from 1993 and it takes place in a city that is kind of like Tim Burton's Gotham, you know, like,
so in a sense they were predicting, you know, the current era of superhero movies where, you know, you take something that's made for kids, you're like, yeah, but what if we made it gritty and serious and for adults?
Well, it's funny because there are some inherent elements in Batman that lend themselves to a grittier take. I mean, his parents were killed in front of him in an alley. He has this psychotic vigilante war on crime that he wages. Whereas,
let's find out about Mario and Luigi's troubled upbringing. All was not well in the Mushroom Kingdom when they were young.
Yeah, the Mario game is basically just a plumber who has adventures and he jumps on turtles and stuff and Goombas. Although, I do think there is something to explore in there. I mean, the class politics of a plumber who is engaged to the Mushroom Queen or whatever that is, Princess Peach, and the society. I mean, it seems to be actually like quite a small D democratic society they have in the Mushroom Kingdom.
Well, I mean, at best, it's a constitutional monarchy if they have a princess.
Well, everybody, though, plays in Mario Kart together. The princess, Bowser, Wario, Luigi. It's a classless society, truly, when they're playing Mario Kart. But have you noticed that in Super Mario World, in every level, Mario is trying to save the princess, but have you noticed that in every level, every single resident of the Mushroom Kingdom wants to kill him?
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have a lot of popular support.
Everyone is aligned with Bowser, the populist ruler who has sort of temporarily dethroned the princess.
Well, right, so I guess, you know, we can extrapolate from that Mario is some kind of vanguardist. He's trying to get ahead of everyone else because they're too brainwashed. He and Luigi perhaps belong to some kind of small sect or something like that. Anyway, I'm sure these issues will be explored in the forthcoming movie with Chris Pratt. Who else is in it? I don't know anything about this movie.
I don't know. I'm not interested in knowing. That's all I have to say about that.
Just further raw material for our show.
So before we get to the movie today, Luke, for a couple of days you've been badgering me to bring this up on the podcast, and I've just wanted to let bygones be bygones. I haven't wanted to wage yet another assault against this man, but... Okay.
Well, it's like I said to you, we have to be the vanguard here because too many people are asleep and they've drunk the Kool-Aid on Tom Hanks, and we're here to set the record straight.
Okay, Tom Hanks. Everyone who listens knows that on this podcast, we consider him a very evil man.
Enemy of the show, Thomas Hanks.
The living embodiment of gentrification. A man whose job it is to suck up all of the cultural icons, be they Mr. Rogers, be they Sully, be they Captain Phillips himself, and graft them on to his body as he becomes the ultimate American man. You know, quite sinister. But again, look, there are a lot of problematic artists where I say, separate the artist from the art. You know, if you enjoy Sleepless in Seattle, then I think that's fine.
I've never seen it.
The work exists independent of the man, just as it does with, say, Roman Polanski or Woody Allen, you know. The folks will love me putting Tom Hanks in that category.
Yeah, I might step in to defend Tom Hanks for a moment here.
Anyway, no, Tom Hanks is fine, whatever. But he had an interview in the New York Times last week. I'm not bringing this up to make fun of him so much as I thought his answer to this question... You know, Tom Hanks is one of America's uber-liberals. Like, he's the guy that when Joe Biden wants somebody to go on TV and explain to the world what's happening, he calls on Tom Hanks. He plays that role in American society. So I just found this answer to the question very interesting to see, like, what's kind of happening in the liberal imagination right now. So the interviewer said to him, "So many of your movies, and also the work you do with Playtone," which is, I think, a company that he runs, "convey an affection for a particular slice of mid-20th century America. That's a period, the period of your youth, that makes a lot of people nostalgic. But nostalgia for that time has curdled for so many Americans into retrograde politics. What makes back in my day tip over into something negative for some people, and why do you think it hasn't for you?" So I'm just going to read you Tom Hanks's response. He says, "That's such a loathsome argument. Back in my day, those days were expletive up." I think he said those days were fucked up. Tom Hanks drops the F-bomb, folks. Those are the times that we're living in. Even the most beloved American is breaking out the swears. Anyway, he continues, "Oh, the 50s were this carefree time? Excuse me, no, they were not. How come things aren't the way they were? You mean when you were comfortable? Institutions were gaming the system in order to maintain the status quo. That has always been the case, except for when some redefinition of our institutions comes along out of a public outcry because the status quo isn't fair."
And that's why I, Tom Hanks, endorsed Bernie Sanders in 2016 and 2020.
Yeah, yeah, not so much. He continues, "I was in a movie called Cloud Atlas that went right over everybody's heads. It said, what is the point of trying to do the right thing when it's just a drop in the ocean? But what is an ocean but a multitude of drops? Things get better when a multitude of drops form an ocean and sweep things away. World War II, the Nazis were defeated, as was a Japanese empire, because enough good people said no."
Is that a multitude of drops, or is it just like states being organized and mass conscription and planning? And like, I don't know if the multitude of drops metaphor kind of holds up here. Sorry to interrupt.
"Civil rights came about because of, I think, an American belief that our responsibility as citizens is to work toward making a more perfect union. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but there's Hanks. He's got a nostalgia for the way America used to be. No, I have a fascination with the progress that America has made in all these incremental moments. That is an American sense of what is right and what is wrong. What I don't do, if I can continue on, I'm not cynical. Cynicism is a default position in an awful lot of entertainment. How many knockoff versions of Chinatown have you seen? 8 million. The conflict of cynicism is glamorous, gorgeous. Violence is glamorous and gorgeous, but it's cynical, and I'm not a cynic." Anyway, an interesting response. I think given, you know, the failure of so many institutions over the last few years, a lot of people wonder, you know, how can certain, I don't know, for want of a better term, liberal ideologues, and I think Tom Hanks falls under that category. Sure. Like, how do the gears of their brains process this, and how does it conform? How does it fit back into that basic principle of the arc of history is long, but it bends towards progress?
Well, what's interesting to me about, you know, that framing of things by Tom Hanks is that, I mean, if that was perhaps coming from someone else, and, you know, wasn't, if that kind of narrative of American history and progress was being discussed in relation to something other than the Tom Hanks cinematic oeuvre. I mean, there's a lot to be sympathetic to and to agree with in that, right? I mean, putting aside the sort of, you know, Time magazine-y quality to a lot of it, you know, it's not a bad reflex to sort of try to pierce the nostalgia people have for our innocent past, you know, whatever the context is, and to say, well, actually, there were great struggles and they produced, you know, tremendous progress. So if you're cynical about, you know, what's going on now, just think about, you know, where we've come from, all the things that have come before, et cetera, et cetera. In thinking about the kind of movie, though, that I associate with Tom Hanks and the kind of sentiment that I associate with, you know, liberals of his generation who talk that way, my mind, you know, turns to things like, you know, and obviously I know Tom Hanks wasn't in this, but I mean, I think of things like the Rob Reiner LBJ movie, for example, that we watched, right, with Woody Harrelson as LBJ. Where, you know, Rob Reiner, who is a guy, debases himself far more than I think Tom Hanks does. You know, I don't think Tom Hanks is really on Twitter being like, you know, live tweeting the Mueller investigation or whatever
and
Rob Reiner's doing.
And good for him for not doing that,
Yeah, Mr. Hanks, we on the Michael and Us podcast salute you for that. We may have many disagreements, but thanks for not being Rob Reiner. But I mean, so, you know, it's not like liberals of this generation exactly do look back into the past and say that everything was great. And it's not that they're dismissive of, you know, the idea of progress or something like that when they're looking back at moments like the 1960s. It's that, to me anyway, their rendering of that history is almost invariably a sort of, you know, like they're Tories when they think about history. I'll turn back to that LBJ movie, right? What was the thesis of that movie, right?
It was that only Nixon can go to China.
Well, it's that there had to be this kind of dialectic of idealism and pragmatism, you know? The idealism is supposed to be represented by the Kennedys who, you know, they're these East Coast liberals and they want to move too fast on civil rights. rights, you know, before the country is ready. And LBJ, who's a Southern, you know, deal maker and pragmatist, he kind of restrains them, but then they also push him. And then eventually, you know, that's how you get civil rights.
And eventually at the end of the movie, he just passes Kennedy's law. There was no compromise at all, according to that film.
Right. So, I mean, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards progress. That kind of idea can have radical implications. But I think in this kind of way of thinking about history, it can be a very conservative sentiment. It's actually an entree to be patient because, you know, progress is slow and morality is gray, and progress ultimately happens through compromise and, you know, institutions move slowly and all the rest of it. And I mean, that's how you square the fact that this type of elite liberal today will talk about the past. You know, they're perfectly happy to be radicals in the past. And then, you know, they're basically small C conservatives in the present. People like Tom Hanks, when they're talking about the present, are not channeling this same sentiment that he did vis-a-vis the past in the passage you just read, where, you know, it's, you know, people realize that, you know, institutions were gaming the system and it was, you know, it was time for change and people said enough is enough or whatever. I mean, the people who do say that, the institutions of elite liberalism tend to actually make an enemy out of those people. And so, I mean, I do find this a very interesting and kind of revealing interview. And, you know, obviously the fact that it's, you know, this stuff is being said by Tom Hanks is immaterial. Who cares, you know?
But, you know, somebody who's on the left might say that the history of progress is one of great struggle. And, you know, progress doesn't happen overnight. It's a lot of people getting together and forming these alliances and struggling to make it happen. And I think Tom Hanks would also say progress doesn't happen overnight. But what eventually happens is when the system becomes so unjust, when there's a flaw in an otherwise good system that becomes so obviously unjust, then there is a mass speaking to the manager. all of us sort of...
A million droplets stand up.
And then the manager listens and says, you're right. We should do something about that. And they fix the system. They fix the flaw in the system rather than upending the system.
Yeah, I mean, something else I noticed about, you know, the passage you read, you know, which is very common. And, you know, we don't want to beat up too much specifically on Tom Hanks about this.
No, he's a good actor. I liked him a lot in The Burbs.
Yeah, you're right. We don't mean to be punching down on this podcast by being too hard on Academy Award winner Tom Hanks. But I mean, the other thing he says in that, right, which is, you know, very typical of this type of sentiment. You know, he says that thing about, you know, civil rights happen because, you know, of a deeply embedded American belief that we always have to build a more perfect union or something like that. And I'm sorry, but that is, you know, if we're talking about noxious nostalgia, I mean, that would definitely be it. The fact is, civil rights were very divisive, right? There were deep polarities in American society because huge numbers of people rejected the idea of equality for Black Americans, and they rejected civil rights. They were against voting drives. They were against integration. And that's true of most real reform and transformation that happens in any society. It's always going to be incredibly divisive. Things are going to be contested. Institutions are going to be uprooted, etc. And so again, this brings us back to, you know, the posture that I find is now so common for kind of a certain type of liberal, and I think it's generational to some extent as well, in the present, which is this sort of semi-radicalism about the past, and then this kind of small C conservatism in the present. You almost get the sense, you know, listening to a quote like that, that something like the civil rights movement and the, you know, successes that it had were almost preordained or destined in some way. You know, they're written into the quote unquote American story, trademark symbol, something like that. And I don't think real social change has ever come from, you know, a kind of wishy-washy view of history like that. Although it's very interesting that's how Tom Hanks thinks about his cinematic oeuvre. And I think it's especially interesting how kind of defensive he is off the top of that. He really doesn't like the nostalgia label.
Sorry, bud, I'm not the one who made Forrest Gump.
Which I've still never seen. We should do that sometime.
Oh, yeah. Montreal, October 1970. It is over 400 years since the French first came to Quebec. It is over 200 years since the English defeated the French here on the Heights of Abraham in Quebec City. It is over 100 years since Canada became a nation which encompasses Quebec. But Quebec's French-speaking population has persistently survived as a living Francophone culture, never forgetting that one day Quebec might become a separate French-speaking state free of outside domination.
Well, a number of times on this podcast, we've tried to make Canadian history come alive, and we're going to try to do it again. It's a quixotic struggle, always tilting towards those windmills, trying to make Canadian history come alive. But Luke believes it can be done. And do we have a story for you today? I think this is the one that's going to do it. Our non-Canadian listeners may not know about the October Crisis, but within Canada, it still looms very large. We watched a documentary from the National Film Board of Canada called Action, The October Crisis of 1970. We'll tell you about the documentary, but I'll just give a brief summarizing of what exactly the October Crisis was. In October 1970, a militant separatist group in the province of Quebec, which was called the Front de Libération du Québec, more commonly known as the FLQ, kidnapped two people, a British diplomat, James Cross, and the provincial labor minister, Pierre Laporte, who was subsequently murdered. This was the culmination of a decade or so of increasingly fraught tension between French and English Canada, although tensions between French and English Canada are really baked into the country's DNA. It also led to Canada's federal government, led by Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, invoking the War Measures Act. This was an emergency measure that the government was able to use to suspend civil liberty, either during times of war, invasion, or insurrection. And this would have fallen under the category of insurrection. The War Measures Act was used during the Second World War, but the October Crisis was the only time it was ever used in peacetime. In 1988, it was repealed and replaced with something called the Emergencies Act. But this use of the War Measures Act, this suspension of civil liberties during peacetime, continues to be a defining moment in Canadian history.
And I'll just jump in here to say that the Emergencies Act, the successor legislation to the War Measures Act, was in fact used for the first time in peacetime just a few months ago. It's been forgotten because, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine at the end of that same week. But the government of Justin Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act because they said it was necessary to deal with the recent occupation in Ottawa. Anyway, we won't get into that.
I will say that it was greeted warmly by the Canadian media, almost as this like sequel to a great Canadian moment. Because another thing you need to understand is one of the most famous pieces of audiovisual media in Canada is an interview that Pierre Trudeau gave to a reporter shortly before he invoked the War Measures Act.
Well, there's a lot of bleeding hearts around who just don't like to see people with helmets and guns. All I can say is go on and bleed, but it's more important to keep law and order in this society than to be worried about weak-kneed people who don't like the looks of a
soldier. At any cost? At any cost? How far would you go with that? How far would you extend that?
Well, just watch me.
So, just watch me. Just watch me is one of the three of the most famous words ever uttered in Canada.
Yeah, it's the name of volume 2 of John English's famous biography of Pierre Trudeau. It's a very famous phrase. I mean, you're taught it. You're taught it in school, and you're basically taught that this was like an ultimate Pierre Trudeau mic drop sort of moment, which is pretty incredible, given that it, you know, preceded the mass suspension of civil liberties. I mean, effectively a kind of declaration of martial law. I think to some extent, reception of this incident, you know, how it's conceived of, you know, throughout the Canadian imaginary, it's been revised a little bit, you know, since. I think there is at least a kind of, if not a majority view, a significant plurality view that invoking the War Measures Act in the way that the government did was incorrect. At the time, it should be said, it was very popular. I think I saw one poll from Gallup from October of 1970, 89% support, something like that. It was invoked before it was actually debated in Parliament, but when it was put to a debate in Parliament, it passed 190-16, the 16 members voting against, all being most of the New Democratic Party caucus. Tommy Douglas, the leader of the NDP, I think in his second last year as leader of the NDP, giving a very impassioned and very cogent speech in the House of Commons, laying out the NDP's opposition to the use of this kind of legislation. A speech that has never been, would you believe it, never become as famous or well-known as Pierre Trudeau saying, "Just watch me," before suspending civil liberties. But a very important moment, I think, in the history of the parliamentary left in Canada. Did the NDP absolutely no favors in the polls because, of course, the government's decision was very popular. I think the NDP ended up sinking to single digits, at least for 6 months. But in retrospect, you know, and we'll get into the reasons why in a little bit, I think what ultimately happened after the government invoked this emergencies legislation and kind of the decades since have really shown that this was the correct stand to take. I guess to get into the film a little bit. I mean, I'll say off the top that I really do like this type of documentary. This is very much a show don't tell style of documentary. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Will, but I believe the filmmaker Robin Spry made it just a few years, I think, after the October crisis itself. So there is a little bit of voiceover narration, I believe, from Spry himself, but it's pretty much just, you know, news footage, extended footage of various politicians and cultural leaders and journalists speaking, often at length.
Yeah, another documentary like this that I really like is called One Nation Under Trump. We watched it a couple weeks ago. Just a lot of news footage about an interesting subject.
Yeah, and you know, as with that film, you can just kind of draw your own conclusions. But so another thing I like about this documentary is I would say at least a third of it, if not 40% of it, is occupied from the very beginning with providing a, you know, a canned, but I think pretty good history of Quebec leading right up to the crisis. The dynamics which culminated in the October crisis go back decades, if not centuries, in, you know, the history of Europeans on the North American continent. If you'll indulge me, Will, I just want to run through a little bit of that history here because I think it's important background to the crisis. Some of this will be known to many people listening already, but you know, obviously, New France, it was one of the earliest European colonies in North America. It was conquered by the English roughly 200 years into its existence. Famously, General Wolfe defeated the French on the Plains of Abraham. And, you know, in the ensuing 200 years or so, French Canadians, the Québécois, were very much a subordinated group of people. Subordinated because they were a linguistic and cultural minority in, you know, a sea of Anglophones, greatly outnumbered by English speakers in North America. But also because the type of regime they had, the form of government that ended up prevailing was in many ways a very oppressive one. I won't run through the whole history of that. But I mean, the Quebec of, for example, the 1930s or 40s, you know, was, you know, run in a big way by the Catholic Church, which was a deeply conservative institution. The ruling government was represented by the Union Nationale Party, most famously Premier Duplessis. And I mean, this was more than a conservative government. I mean, this was a government that had people who, you know, admired Salazar's Portugal. It was an incredibly repressive and backward-looking government. In the words of the Quebec trade unionist Pierre Vaudeboncourt, he characterized the Union Nationale and Premier Duplessis, its policy, as resisting assimilation from without by resisting emancipation from within. And part of that was being in cahoots with the Anglophone business community outside of Quebec and with a handful of American corporations. So you have a dynamic where the French-speaking majority in Quebec did not control its own natural resources, was deeply exploited as a labor force. I think it was the 1930s. There was a famous labor study to come out of Quebec, which found that the typical workplace dynamic, you know, your typical shop floor, you'd have most of the workers would be unilingual Francophones, and the manager or boss would be a unilingual Anglophone, and then there'd be a foreman who would be bilingual. So the linguistic divide there essentially mapping on perfectly to, you know, the class divide in Quebec society. Now, all of this was uprooted by the Quiet Revolution. And just finally, to give a flavor for what the mindset of the people running Quebec was on the eve of the Quiet Revolution, I want to read from a radio broadcast, June 20th, 1956. This was just before Duplessis' final election victory. This gives a sense of what the mindset of the Union Nationale was in its running of Quebec. Sovereign authority by whatever government it is exercised is derived solely from God, the supreme and eternal principle of all power. It is therefore an absolute error to believe that authority comes from the multitudes, from the masses, from the people. To pretend that authority does not properly belong to those who exercise it, but that they have only a simple mandate revocable at any time by the people. This error, which dates from the Reformation, rests on the false principle that man has no other master than his own reason. All this explanation about the origin, the basis, and the composition of this alleged sovereignty of the people is purely arbitrary. Moreover, if it is admitted, it will have as a consequence the weakening of authority, making it a myth, giving it an unstable and unchangeable basis, stimulating popular passions, and encouraging sedition. Well, despite the efforts of the forces of conservatism in Quebec, the popular passions were, suffice it to say, very stimulated in the following decade. Quebec, through what became known as the Quiet Revolution, underwent a social transformation of incredibly rapid proportions. There were a number of other factors kind of leading up to this. There was growing urbanization, industrialization. There were also a number of strikes that were brutally suppressed, notably the famous asbestos strike in eastern Quebec, in which many key trade union leaders who would go on to be national politicians were involved, Jean Peltier and Pierre Trudeau as well, being prominent supporters of the workers during that strike. Trudeau later wrote what he found there when he visited the workers was a Quebec I did not really know of, that of workers exploited by management, denounced by government, clubbed by police, and yet burning with fervent militancy. The strike was significant because it occurred at a time when we were witnessing the passing of a world, precisely at a moment when our social framework, the worm-eaten remnants of a bygone age, were ready to come apart. So without running through the whole history of the Quiet Revolution, things really turned with the election of Premier Jean Lesage and the Liberals in 1960. They campaigned on a very powerful slogan, Maître chez nous, masters in our own house. So the nationalist impulse really came together with a kind of democratic socialist one as well. René Lévesque, who later went on to be the PQ Premier of Quebec, Parti Québécois, he was a minister in that government, and one of the things he helped preside over was the nationalization of hydroelectricity, which came to be seen as symbolic of Quebec and Quebecers becoming masters in their own house. By the middle of the 1960s, or maybe by the late 1960s, there's increasingly a divide within the ruling Quebec Liberals and within the new, much more liberal, progressive, and social democratic circles who are now in many cases running the province and who hold influential positions in the province. Some figures, like Pierre Trudeau, most famously, decide that the natural endpoint of the Quiet Revolution is to assert the French fact within Canada through things like official bilingualism. Others, like Lévesque, who ends up leaving the Liberal Party and helping found the Parti Québécois, they believe that Quebec can only ever achieve self-determination through independence, and they mobilize around that political objective. Now, of course, this being the late 60s, there's a lot of radical ferment in the air generally. And throughout the 1960s, this group, the FLQ, which is sort of ostensibly a leftist revolutionary group committed to Quebec sovereignty and Quebec independence, carries out a number of bombings throughout the province. You know, they bomb public buildings. They famously bombed, you know, the CP Railway, a shoe factory, Montreal City Hall. These bombings over the course of years leave, I think, 6 people dead. But their activities culminate, as Will mentioned already, in the kidnapping of the British Trade Commissioner James Cross, and then I believe about a week later, the kidnapping of the Minister of Labor and Immigration, Pierre Laporte, who's subsequently murdered and found in the back of a car. This prompts a national crisis, really. The Quebec government eventually appeals to the federal government. Authorities in Quebec, Montreal Mayor Jean Drapeau, Liberal Premier Robert Bourassa, appeal to Trudeau and the federal government to grant emergency powers. And the powers that are invoked here through the War Measures Act really are quite extensive. They involve the suspension of habeas corpus, the locking up indiscriminately of all kinds of people without trial. René Lévesque later wrote in his memoirs, indiscriminately union leaders, artists, writers, whoever had dared cast doubt upon official verities or simply those the unleashed bloodhounds didn't like the look of were thrown into paddy wagons and put away. Deprived of their rights, beginning with habeas corpus, a great many of them were to remain in custody for days or weeks. And it needs to be said, you know, this emergency legislation applied across the whole country. So, there are obvious avenues for a very significant abuse of this kind of police powers. Tommy Douglas, leader of the NDP, appeared in the documentary at one point, and he's, you know, refers to various places where it's already being abused. One instance that I looked into that he mentions was the mayor of Vancouver, who was, I don't know, some right-wing asshole, basically saying, well, now that this legislation's on the books, this is a good time to clear out, you know, the drug addicts and the draft dodgers and the hippies. There was some mayor on the prairies, I'm not sure who it was, who said, you know, well, you know, there's a lot of people you want to pick up. If you're the police, this is probably a good time to do it, you know, clear out the rabble. Eventually, there's a debate in Parliament over this, in which Douglas gives a quite lengthy speech, is unable to persuade most members of Parliament to vote against the legislation. And as I said, it passed 190-16, with the 16 members being the bulk of the NDP caucus.
The Front de Libération du Québec is not the Messiah, nor a modern-day Robin Hood. It is a regrouping of Quebec workers who have decided to use every means at their disposal to ensure that the people of Quebec assume control of their own destiny. The Front de Libération du Québec wants complete independence for all Quebecers, united in a free society, purged forever of its clique of voracious sharks.
I have more questions than insights on this documentary, so I'd like to pose a couple of them to you. When we were watching this, one of the things you mentioned was that one of the reasons why we don't really have a social democratic country in Canada is because of this 10 or 15 year period of first the Quiet Revolution and then the tensions that we see in this documentary. Wondering if you could expand on that a little bit.
The only way I think that we were ever going to have kind of pan-Canadian socialism, if you want, in Canada, the only way we were going to have even just the type of political dynamic that ended up prevailing in a lot of European countries where, you know, beginning in the 1920s, but in some countries, Britain, for example, but especially after the war, you know, often the party systems kind of split into two basic chunks, you know, depending on the electoral system. Often you just have, you know, one kind of labor, socialist or social democratic party on the one hand, and you have some kind of conservative party that represents traditionalism, but also is closely aligned with, you know, business management, that kind of thing. I mean, in Britain, you have Labour and the Tories beginning in the 1920s. In Germany, you have the Christian Democrats and the SPD. In France, the Socialist Party and the Gaullists. I mean, this is the divide that throughout much of the 20th century, you know, many industrialized democracies had. In Canada, that is not the party system or the kind of basic polarity we had at the federal level. Instead, you know, there was a Socialist Party beginning with the CCF and then later the NDP, which had representation in Parliament. But the central fact of Canadian federal politics, you know, I think really between the 1960s and, I mean, really right up through the 1990s, was one that in a sense came out of the Quiet Revolution and the divides within Quebec over what the correct endpoint of the Quiet Revolution was. So for Pierre Trudeau, it was asserting the French fact within Canada. And, you know, for others who were often people to Trudeau's left, it was self-determination for the people of Quebec in the form of a sovereign, independent nation state. So what I was getting at with that comment is that it's always struck me that, you know, all of the constituencies that would have been necessary to build a kind of pan-Canadian socialism of the kind that, you know, the CCF was trying to build, and then the NDP in the 60s and 70s was persistently trying to break through in Quebec and failing. You know, a big reason for that was that all of the constituencies that would probably be natural sort of NDP constituencies, the Federation of Quebec Trade Unions, for example, even just many of the trade union leaders themselves, they got involved on one side or another of the debate within Quebec and its proxy debates in federal politics. The question of sovereignty or separatism on the one hand, or, you know, the very aggressive kind of federalism promoted by Pierre Trudeau on the other, became an all-consuming question. And so figures like René Lévesque, who I believe was asked to run, if not for the NDP, for the CCF, those would have been the cabinet ministers from Quebec in a national NDP government in a world where the Quiet Revolution had a different outcome. There were people who came out of that milieu who were involved in the NDP. Probably one of the most famous ones was Charles Taylor, who Trudeau actually supported, I think, in 1965. When he ran, maybe it was 1963 when he ran for the NDP. Trudeau was very nasty, famously, to Lester Pearson, said a lot of mean things about him that are pretty funny. And then, of course, when he was asked to run for the Liberals a few years later, he did, and ended up running against his friend Charles Taylor. Figures like Taylor tried to argue that the interests of Quebec, as many of the sovereigntists and separatists saw it, could be realized within Canada if Canada also became a more equal society. And, you know, so I'm not saying any of this exactly to pronounce my disappointment with, you know, the Quebec left of the 1960s and 70s, that, you know, it didn't get on board with a broader left national project in Canada. I'm just describing what I think the dynamics were and why Canada ended up having this party system and this political dynamic, which really for 25 or 30 or even 40 years was really quite unlike the dynamic in many European countries in particular.
The issue of Quebec separatism has never entirely gone away, although it has sort of waxed and waned over the last 50 years. Where is Quebec at with that?
I mean, I think it's basically nowhere. And we should say, I mean, this documentary being made in the 70s doesn't get into any of the subsequent history, you know, after the October crisis. As parts of the Quiet Revolution continue to roll on, the PQ under René Lévesque eventually did take power in 1976, leading to the referendum of, I think, 1980. Forgive me if I'm getting the date wrong. It's around that time in which the separatist cause is resoundingly defeated. There's then a second referendum in 1995, which comes about 50,000 votes. I mean, the yes side loses only by, you know, 50, 53,000 votes, something like that. There's a pretty good documentary actually made by the CBC called Breaking Point, which we should deal with on the show sometime. But after the Quiet Revolution, after the October Crisis, after the referendum of 1980, these divides really don't go away. And in many ways, they worsen. Quebec doesn't sign on to the Constitution. Trudeau can't get Quebec's signature on the charter, on his constitutional negotiations of the early 1980s. Brian Mulroney was conservative prime minister during the 1980s. He tries to get Quebec, he was from Quebec as well, tries to get Quebec's signature on the Constitution through the Meech Lake Accord. That fails. Later, there's something called the Charlottetown Accord, which is put to a vote. That fails as well. So all of this culminates in there's a lot of frustration and anger in Quebec. In the 1995 referendum, the Federalist side, for the most part, does, I think, a pretty horrible job of making the case for why the yes side is wrong. And then actually during the early 2000s, during the sponsorship scandal, which ends up bringing down the federal Liberal government under Paul Martin.
Which was, by the way, just kind of garden variety Liberal Party corruption, right?
Oh, yeah. I was like, I'm forgetting the details, but it involved something like plush contracts for Liberal aligned, you know, advertisers or something like that.
This is what brings down every Liberal government.
I'm forgetting now. It was boring as hell, but it was something that people were justifiably angry about. Anyway, at the height of that, polls showed support for Quebec independence to be in the majority. I think historically there's been a bit of a teeter-totter around that question in terms of public opinion. During the 95 referendum, and you know, we'll get into this in detail when we come to that documentary later, but there was a lot of dispute about what a yes vote would actually have meant, because the question that was put to the people of Quebec was famously unclear. You know, the ballot question was not, do you want a sovereign, independent Quebec? It was a very convoluted question with multiple clauses and things like that. Had the yes side won by 10,000 votes or something? I mean, I don't know. I mean, there would have been a very serious crisis, because the federal government would have stepped in and said, well, this is not a vote for separation. Don't know what happens then. The country arguably came pretty close to breaking up. In terms of where things are at now in the politics of Quebec, I mean, the PQ, which in some ways, I mean, is the founding party, or I suppose one of the founding parties of modern Quebec, is, I mean, risking oblivion at this point. In the last poll I saw, it was at 9%. I mean, so that's behind the newly formed Conservative Party of Quebec, which was at 14% in the same poll. Also at 14% was Quebec Solidaire, which is the left-wing party in Quebec. The Liberal Party, which, you know, famously formed a government in 1960 and kind of implemented many of the reforms associated with the Quiet Revolution, it's at 18%. And out in front is the CAQ Party. I'm gonna pronounce it badly, so forgive me. If you're listening from Quebec, the Coalition d'Avenir du Québec, which is the governing party under François Legault. And the CAQ Party is kind of I mean, I think in some ways it's analogous to what Emmanuel Macron has done in France, where he basically took the sort of more neoliberal elements of both of the existing parties and was sort of like, what do we just put our differences aside and worked on what we agree on, which is just, you know, neoliberalism and business. And so, you know, the CAQ kind of did that with the sovereignty question. They kind of said, well, let's just put a pin in this and, you know, let's invite various, you know, members of different parties in Quebec to run for us and form a new ruling bloc. And right now that bloc looks pretty impregnable. With 43% of the vote in Quebec, which has, you know, a British parliamentary system, first past the post, produces results even more skewed than the ones we just got in Ontario, the ones we get nationwide in terms of percentages of the vote and how many seats they end up giving parties in the National Assembly. So, I mean, it would be premature to predict, you know, the death of anything. But right now, I mean, I think it's safe to say that the question of Quebec independence is at a very low ebb by historical standards. And I mean, maybe part of that is, you know, from my point of view, as someone who grew up in Ontario, you know, went to English Canadian public school and was constantly treated to these sort of anguished sermons about, like, what does it mean to be a Canadian? You know, what is Canada? My sense anytime I visited Quebec is that this is not a problem for the people and culture of Quebec. Quebec feels very much like a distinct society. You know, one of the things you notice as an outsider if you visit is that, you know, Quebecers have their own star system. They have their own celebrities. They have their own literature.
They have a much more robust cultural ecosystem than English Canada.
Much more robust and self-confident. And of course, united around, you know, just basic facts like French being the majority language that's spoken in Quebec. So I think the kind of case that was being made by, you know, people like Levesque in the 60s and 70s, I mean, in some very obvious ways, the conditions that made that case more persuasive to people have just evaporated somewhat. I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that, you know, before the Quiet Revolution, Quebec was a kind of quasi-colonized society. So the kind of radical impulses that come out of that, in many cases, in many areas, made a lot of sense. One other thing I'll say about this, as, you know, a left-wing English-Canadian who's taken an interest in Quebec, is that you notice that just like everything else over the past 30 or 40 years, Quebec nationalism, you know, in the post-René Lévesque era got, you know, it got a lot less sexy, if I can put it that way. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, you know, it's in partnership with trade unions and it's, you know, basically kind of democratic socialist in orientation. When we watch the CBC documentary about the 1995 referendum, you know, we really get the sense of in that is that the baton of kind of nationalism has really been passed from the activist state of the Quiet Revolution just to like business in Quebec. So now it's just like various CEOs and stuff like that fronting for the sovereigntist cause. I'm forgetting the guy's name now. He was hastily forgotten. But there was that guy who I think succeeded Pauline Marois as leader of the PQ in the last decade, who was just some like right-wing media baron or something. And so like when a guy like that is the face of kind of, you know, the official sovereigntist cause, I mean, I think it becomes a lot less interesting. And so my sense is that that's kind of contributed to the decline of the more kind of a passionate vision of Quebec independence that, you know, was associated with, you know, the 1960s and 70s.
Comme trouvé dans une atmosphère du même genre que celle de la libération. Vive le Québec. Vive le Québec libre.
Watching this documentary and seeing all of the strife and violence that happened in Quebec in the 1960s did have me thinking about the Canadian identity. Perhaps, as you alluded to earlier, we English Canadian people are more prone to thinking deep and worrying and fretting about the Canadian identity. And just to end the episode, I want to read a little bit from one of the greatest Canadian public intellectuals, Stephen Marsh. This is an article he wrote in 2014 for Esquire magazine about a shooting that took place that year on Parliament Hill. Stephen Marsh, for those who don't know him, really for a while had this incredible gig of explaining Canada to foreigners in some of the
something
biggest,
I wouldn't know anything about
in some of the biggest mainstream magazines, you know, GQ, Esquire, The Guardian.
I guess I wouldn't actually know about that.
The article is called Canada, the Idea is in Pieces. And I'll just read a couple of little excerpts from it. There's a lovely wide lawn around the Parliament buildings on which families play frisbee and walk dogs and occasionally protest. Even as I write this, I realize that I should switch to the past tense, because I am describing a world that is past. That open place, the Canada whose institutions I believe to be so safe, so secure, has passed. All of that was the Canada of my youth. This is the Canada now. If I'm being honest, I guess I believe that we were too irrelevant to be attacked, too marginal, too inconsequential. Canada didn't fight the Iraq War. It fought in Afghanistan, but it was always a follower or a refuser, never an inspirer. Ottawa is not exactly London or New York. It's no Bombay either. I also believed, naively, that what distinguishes Canada from the rest of the Western world would also somehow register in the minds of terrorists. Canada is one of the most open societies in the world. We are one of the only countries in the West that does not have an explicitly anti-immigrant national party. Canadians are about as far as it is possible to get from warmongers, no matter what, to Glenn Greenwald, in his supreme self-righteousness, believes. It is hard to project Canadians as one of the world's great oppressors, but in hindsight, it was idiotic to imagine that our substance would matter to the kind of people who run up to war memorials and shoot the guards. Later on, he writes, "My emotions are not sufficient to the situation. As pathetic and sentimental and useless as it is, what I feel is heartbroken. A very precious thing has been smashed. A very beautiful idea for how a country can run has been assaulted. With near-perfect symbolism, the Prime Minister was forced to cancel a ceremony to confer honorary citizenship on Nobel Prize winner Malala because of the attack. Hope personified, deferred indefinitely because of stupid, pointless violence."
So so we should say the background to this was, I believe, the Parliament Hill shooting of, I think, 2015, 2014. this was an incident that was a very big deal at the time. It was momentarily pretty scary. It's not really talked about very much anymore because I think it became...
Well, there's no Canada to talk about anymore. It ruptured the fabric of an otherwise a previously spotless nation with nothing on its conscience.
So this was basically a mentally ill guy with a gun who, because there was lax security on Parliament Hill, was actually able to enter Parliament. He fired a few shots in there. You know, it was genuinely quite scary because people didn't know what was going on. The MP I worked for was there and, you know, told me it was pretty terrifying. They shut the door of the NDP caucus room. And later when I visited Parliament, I saw the bullet holes were still there. So, you know, pretty scary stuff. But, you know, at the time, our national media really panicked. People really freaked out. I mean, I'm not saying this to defend Stephen Marsh and that absolute drivel that you just read. But, you know, this was very much kind of what the environment at the time was. And actually, as a result, a lot about the story as it was breaking, you know, the news media just got it completely wrong. There was talk of multiple shooters. That just wasn't true. The whole thing was talked about as a terrorist attack, which it manifestly wasn't. You know, there was this kind of whole ISIS comes to Ottawa story that was told about it. Just absolutely not true. There was a whole kind of heroic story told about how the sergeant at arms in Parliament single-handedly like subdued the attacker. And then, you know, later it turned out that various security, you know, shot at the guy. He was kind of bleeding out. And I guess the sergeant at arms went up and like fired the final bullet like into him or something while he was bleeding out. So there was a lot that was gotten wrong about this story. And I do think that Marsh was channeling a certain kind of sentiment at the time. This was certainly in the air, this kind of, oh, we're such an innocent country, nothing bad has ever happened here, and you know, now this, how will we possibly endure?
Well, he was born in 1976, so technically his youth did not overlap with the events of the documentary we watched today.
Right, and nothing violent in Canada happened, as we know, between 1976 and 2015. Anyway, that kind of article, I mean, I'm such a broken record on this, but the type of Canadian exceptionalism that's channeling, where it's just like making stuff up. It's like, of course, there is a sense in which Canada is a uniquely kind of multicultural and in many ways open society, but it's just absurd to pretend that a moment like that represents some sort of, you know, loss of innocence or something like that. I mean, I think even the documentary we watched today referred to the October crisis as a loss of innocence. And I mean, the October crisis was much more serious than what happened on Parliament Hill in 2014. But even that seems like a bit of a stretch. Anyway, Will is about to surpass Stephen Marsh in terms of Twitter followers. So if you're listening to this podcast and have Twitter, somehow don't follow Will Sloan, now's your chance to help him officially become the country's premier public intellectual by getting him ahead of the person who currently holds the title, Mr. Stephen Marsh.
Forest Hill is shaking.
I think to send this one out, we'll leave you all with excerpts from Tommy Douglas's speech in 1970 opposing the War Measures Act. Not as famous as Just Watch Me, but probably should be.
This is the first time, to my knowledge, in Canadian history that the War Measures Act has been invoked in peacetime. Now, I want to say, as far as New Democratic Party is concerned, we have been prepared and we are prepared to support enlarging the police powers, if the government thinks it necessary, to give them greater authority in the matter of search for dynamite or offensive weapons. This is overkill on a gargantuan scale. Why has the government invoked the War Measures Act? Why has the government invoked the War Measures Act? May I point out that the FLQ have been around for some 6 or 7 years. For several years now, it is well known that they have committed and been found guilty of acts of sabotage, putting bombs in mailboxes, blowing up parts or all of public buildings. There is no constitution in this country, no Bill of Rights, no provincial constitution. This government now has the power by order in council to do anything it wants, to intern any citizen, to deport any citizen, to arrest any person, to declare any organization subversive and illegal. These are tremendous powers to put into the hands of the men who sit on the Treasury bench. A person in Canada can be held for 90 days or more without any opportunity to prove their innocence, any opportunity to prove that they didn't belong to a subversive organization, or to prove that the organization to which they belonged was not subversive, in spite of what may be in the minds of those who arrested them. These regulations give the power to seize property and hold it for 90 days. This is a resurrection of the padlock law. These are very serious powers. And if a government required those kinds of powers, surely in a democracy they should have asked the democratically elected representatives of the people to give them those powers. That the government's action today is an action of panic. I think that in the hysteria which people feel, that the government may, as the Prime Minister said, get many letters and calls approving what they're doing. I predict, Mr. Speaker, that within 6 months, when the Canadian people have had time to think of what has taken place today, the removal of all the protection and liberties they have on the statute books of Canada, a country put under the War Measures Act, regulations introduced that allow a person to be detained for 90 days without a chance to prove their innocence. When that day comes, the Canadian people will look upon this as the Black Friday of civil liberties in Canada.